call the Senate Finance Committee to order this afternoon, April 29th, we're in State Capitol Senate Finance Room. It is 1:30. Present today, Chairman Olson, Chairman Stedman, Senator Keel, Senator Merrick, Senator Kaufman, Senator Cronk, and myself, Senator Hoffman. We have a few items on today's agenda, first being CS2 for the operating and mental health budgets. I would ask Senator Stedman for a motion to adopt the CS.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that the Senate Finance Committee adopt the Senate Committee Substitute for Committee Substitute for House Bill 263 Finance 34-GH-2498-E before the committee as our working document.
And I will object for Pete Eklund to explain the adopted CS. Mr. Eklund.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Pete Eklund, staff to Senator Hoffman and the Senate Finance Committee. I'm going to be going through the changes from the version of the 263 that was adopted by this committee last week. That was version U. The version in front of you now is version E. Mr. Chairman, so the new committee substitute makes the following fund changes. Mr. Chairman, in UGF, it adds, I'm rounding, $13.8 million. That's unrestricted general funds. In designated general funds, there's a reduction of just under $2 million. In other state funds, there's an addition of about $1.9 million. And in federal funds, there's an addition of about $95,000 for a total change of about $13.8 million in all funds. Mr. Chairman, I'll go on to the FY27 number section changes. In the Department of Administration, there's an increase of $50,000 to the Office of Public Advocacy and Federal Receipts for the Court-Appointed Special Advocate, or CASA, and the Guardian Ad Litem programs. Into the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development, there was added intent language to encourage the timely payment of community assistance funds so communities have cash available to help with increased fuel and shipping costs. Also in DCCED, there's a fund source swap in the Alaska Energy Authority Railboat Transmission Organization of $653,000 between the Railboat Energy Fund, which is a UGF fund, and regular UGF, or unrestricted general funds, because the Railboat Energy Fund has a zero fund balance. In the Department of Education and Early Development, there's added $450,000 of unrestricted general funds for utility costs, activities, travel, and contractual mental health services for Mount Edgecombe High School. Moving on to the Department of Health, Mr. Chairman. In the Division of Public Assistance, there's an increase of just over $3 million of UGF for maintenance of effort for tribal temporary assistance for needy families, or TANF, and the Alaska Temporary Assistance Program. In the Department of Public Safety, there's a net zero fund source change for rural trooper housing of just under $2 million from designated general funds to unrestricted general funds. Also in DPS, there's an addition in dispatch services of $925,000 unrestricted general funds for increased contractual costs. In the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault, or CDVSA, there's added $600,000 of UGF for direct service provider grants and $250,000 of UGF for legal services to replace declining federal Victims of Crime Act, or VOCA, funds. Also, there were many salary adjustments across the entire department in the personal services line for the Public Safety Employees Association, or PSEA, contract, resulting in a total increase of just over $5.6 million of all funds. The contract is approved in the language section of the bill, which is Section 38, the Salary and Benefit Adjustment section. Moving on to the Department of Revenue, We've added wordage directing DOR to seek tax exemptions for the energy relief portion of the 2026 PFD, or permanent fund dividend, consistent with the tax-exempt status of the 2022 energy relief program. In the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities, we've added just over $1.8 million of international airport revenue funds for the Anchorage and Fairbanks Airport police and fire officers represented by the PSEA contract that I just talked about a minute ago. And we've also authorized the approval of the contract in the language section of the budget under the salary and benefits adjustments section 38 of the bill. Moving on to the judiciary, there's an increase of just 363.5 thousand UGF for the trial courts, the court visitor program. In the legislature, there's an increase of $400,000 of UGF to the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee, so the committee can contract out for a public school funding adequacy study. Then now moving to the supplemental number section, Mr. Chairman. So there's new supplementals starting in section 4. And the fund totals are as follows. Just over $2.55 million of unrestricted general funds, $869,000 of federal funds, for a total addition to the supplemental of about $3.4 million. So, Mr. Chairman, in the Department of Administration, there's a supplemental of $50,000 to the Office of Public Advocacy of Federal Receipt Authority, consistent with the FY27 change that I mentioned earlier for the same purpose. The supplemental Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development, there's an $800,000 UGF named recipient grant to the Cook Inlet Tribal Council for federal TANF maintenance of effort to help with the influx of around 200 people displaced by Typhoon Halong. In the Alaska Energy Authority, there's a net zero fund source swap of $98,700 to replace insufficient relevant energy funds. As I mentioned earlier, that there's a zero balance in that fund with regular unrestricted general funds. Moving on to supplemental language section changes in the Department of Law, Section 7A, Judgments and Settlements. There was an added $1.58 million of UGF for new judgments and settlements for a total of just over $2.1 million in judgments and settlements. Supplemental fund capitalization in Section 9, there's $163.8 million UGF and $819,000 of federal funds to the election fund, which is required by the Help America Vote Act. Supplemental special appropriations. The next change, Mr. Chairman, is on page 67, line 8, which amends last year's surplus waterfall, and it adds $11 million to the outside the formula funding for the base student allocation for a new total of $111 million. And finally, Mr. Chairman, there's FY27 language section changes in the Department of Commerce and Community and Economic Development, Section 21, Subsection L. There are 7.4 thousand of unrestricted general funds of NRA license plate revenue to grants for shooting programs and competitions. And lastly, Mr. Chairman, in Section 21, Subsection M, there is a proposal supported by Senator Cronk for $300,000 of UGF to grant to the Alaska Farmers Market Association for the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, and Women, Infants, and Children's Program, or WIC, and in the Senior Nutrition Program. So that would match SNAP and WIC benefits when those beneficiaries go to farmers markets to buy fresh produce. Those are the changes, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Eklund, for those detailed explanations. Do members of the Senate Finance Committee have specific questions on the CS as presented by Mr. Eklund? Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I had a question about the directed grant from the license plates. It's appropriate that goes to the youth shooting sports. That's where it's gone for a while. My understanding is that's a specific grantee. Does that money benefit youth shooting around the state? It's hardly enough, not like it's enough for a competitive program, right? It's $7,400. But do we have information on where that goes around the state?
Senator Keel, through the chair, Senator Keel, Senator Kronk has a list of in the backup of all the different eligible shooting ranges for that. There's quite a list. If I could defer to Senator Kronk.
Senator Kronk.
Thank you, through the chair. Senator Keel, I have a list here. If you know, I could read through it or I could get this list to you.
I'd appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Keel. Senator Stedman.
Can we have it read through for the public, or, Mr. Chairman?
Senator Kronk.
Through the chair, thank you. The list is the Alaska 49ers, which is a former Susitna Shooters, South Central. Alaska's Yes Varsity statewide. Colony Knights, Yes, South Central. Devil's Thumb Shooters, Petersburg. Haynes Glacier Bears, Haynes Hot Shots. Houston Hawks, South Central. Ketchikan Junior Shotgun League, Ketchikan. Palmer Moose, Peninsula Shooting Stars, Kenai Soldotna, Redding Huskies, Matsu, Sitka Shore Shots, Sitka, Sioux Valley Rams, Susitna, Willow Area, Toke Wolverine Trap, which is in Toke, Upper Susitna All-Stars, Susitna Willow, and Wasilla Warriors, Yes, South Central. So those are the lists that I have.
Thank you, Senator Stedman. In Western Alaska, it's wide open, so we just go out to the whole range is a shooting range for us in Western Alaska. So further questions on Mr. Eklund's presentation? With that, I will remove my objection. Is there further objection to the adoption of the CS? Seeing none, we'll put this aside for further consideration tomorrow.
So that can we have a brief
adies? Can I have a brief adies?
Brief adies. Just to file the meeting back to order, do you have any amendments at this time?
I offer amendment number one.
Amendment number one has been offered, and I will object. Senator Kaufman.
Thank you. The intent of amendment number one is to reduce our POMV draw from the 5% down to the 4.9% number, which is a number that's been discussed as kind of the entry point that we would start to do on our legislation to try and taper the POMV draw. And the reason for this is that we have a sudden windfall of revenue that's coming in, but I'm concerned that we're not taking this opportunity to hold some funds in reserve to the extent that we could, and we're taking the same amount from the POMV, despite the fact that we have additional revenue coming in. So this amendment would simply reduce our draw from a 5% POMV to 4.9%.
I know this topic has come before the committee in a earlier piece of legislation. Senator Stedman, do you have comments?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, the committee's been looking at, for those watching at home, phasing in a reduction in the payout from the permanent fund from 5% of the trailing five of this last 6 years, which we've done for years, but slowly moving that down to 4.5 over a five-year period, slowly ratcheting it down. So we're working on that, Mr. Chairman. One of the things I would like to note that I remind people we're using $73 a barrel for our target, and we're not using the 100 or 110 or whatever the price is today to be a little on the conservative side. So that's the history, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Stedman. Senator Kaufman, comment?
Well, I think, you know, the 5%, that's a statutory limit, and so that's always voluntarily adhered to. We could, with the will of the legislature, we could bust through that, and I think it's an opportunity to reinforce the fact that we won't by trying to draw down less than the 5% and show that we can also go the other way. We can start to pull back on how hard we're tapping the permanent fund, and that will send a tremendous signal, I believe, to people that we don't always take the maximum draw when we don't have to. And I think this year it's has been a, you know, a blessing and a curse. We've gotten additional revenue because of a very difficult situation that's occurred. But we do have this opportunity, so I would hope that we could at least try to exercise that additional restraint that we exercise beyond the normal restraint we show with the 5% POMB.
Thank you. Understanding the higher prices of oil nationwide as a result of the war has directly impacted people that we represent. It's causing problems for school districts and communities as well. So we've come up with appropriations in the operating budget to try to mitigate some of these higher expenses as a result of the pain that this higher oil price is providing. But I would concur that we need to keep a mindful eye on what we're doing with our very precious dollars that we have. And I don't believe we've, while I've been here as chairman, overspent the POMV draw. So I would maintain my objection. Senator Kaufman, do you have any closing comments before we vote?
No, and again, that's just from 5% to 4.9, so I'm not trying to pull down a full percentage point.
Roll call, please.
Senator Kaufman.
Yes.
Senator Keel.
No.
Senator Merrick.
Yes.
Senator Kronk.
Yes.
Senator Olson.
No.
Senator Hoffman.
No.
Senator Stedman.
No.
3 yeas, 4 nays.
Thank you. That motion fails. We have amendment number 2. Senator Kaufman.
Thank you. I move amendment number 2.
I will object to amendment number 2. Please explain.
Well, amendment number 2, now that we're certain we're spending all that money, I figured I'd take a shot at making sure we're actually doing a good job with it. And so little old amendment 2, who never meant no one no harm, all it's trying to do is offer the administration $1.5 million for the purposes of hiring a competent, qualified performance management contractor to come in and do a survey of what we're doing in the state, how we're doing it, look for areas of efficiency, look for the things that we're doing that are either redundant, duplicative, or otherwise non-value-adding, and give us a report. And the idea of this, at this point in time, we have a new chief executive coming in. I would like them to come in with some sort of analysis of what we could do better that was done by, again, a very competent, qualified outfit that knows how to do this sort of efficiency review. We listen to a lot of reports from our ledge audit folks. They're doing audits that are designed to look at conformance, compliance. They're a different sort of audit than what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the type of audit that multi-billion dollar operations like the state of Alaska should be doing to look for the efficiencies with what we're doing with the money, with how we're organized, how we're executing the work that we do every day as the state of Alaska. So that 1.5, it's a tiny little drop in the bucket compared to these big dollars that we are throwing around this table. And it would be the only money that we're spending to make sure that we're actually doing a great job of knowing that what we're spending is actually going for the better good.
And in concept, Senator Kaufman, I would agree with all of your points, but while I've been the chairman, I've been as conservative as I can be. I have eliminated many requests from the administration, from chairman of the subcommittees, and from members of this committee as well. So at this point, I would say that can be considered in the future, especially the provisions that you have in here that address AI, but I will maintain my objection. Closing comments?
Say, it looks like Elon's calling me right now. Again, I believe this type of oversight of what we're doing in the state is needed. So if we don't do it here at the table with this amendment, I hope we do it. Maybe we if this doesn't pass, we can do it next year. But I'm thinking of all the money that we're perhaps losing by not knowing really that we're optimized in what we're doing in the departments. I think there's opportunities to recover more than the simple $1.5 million that my estimate worked up for what we'd need to get a good contractor to come in and tear through the place. Supplemented by the capabilities of AI, you can really do a lot of cross-comparison between departments, look for duplication of effort, and especially with money that's going to non-governmental entities and how that's being utilized.
Thank you. I will maintain my objection. Roll call, please.
Senator Keel.
No.
Senator Merrick.
No.
Senator Cronk.
Yes.
Senator Kaufman.
Yes.
Senator Stedman.
No.
Senator Hoffman.
No.
Senator Olson.
No.
2 yeas, 5 nays.
So that amendment does not get the necessary 4 votes. And fails. That brings before the Finance Committee amendment number 3 to the 2026 session operating budget. Senator Kaufman.
I move amendment number 3.
And I will object. Please explain what you're trying to do with your amendment, Senator Kaufman.
Well, the theme here, we tried spending a little bit less, and then we tried doing better with what we're spending. So now I'm going for transparency, for truth in governance. And so what this bill, it doesn't take any money from anybody. It's not trying to cut anything. All it's trying to do is clean up what's sometimes referred to as the waterfall language so that we're very clear of the year, the fiscal year that the revenue is from, and we're not taking revenue from the prior year and spending it as its current year revenue. What we're doing is we'd actually move it, as I believe it should, through a reserve fund, it'd be CBR, SBR, move it into the reserve fund, and then appropriate from there. That way there would be transparency in what we're doing. We're not kind of commingling the year, sort of stretching out the prior year's revenue and using it as present-day revenue. So it's really just a transparency amendment.
It would make it a little bit more transparent, but I don't know if it's difficult for people, but it's not difficult for me to follow. So, Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think that the concept here is a good concept to take the 26 money, keep it in 26 or 27 and 27. But I think, Mr. Chairman, as we've discussed, trying to get some of this emergency monies out to people sooner than later. I think there would be a delay if we use 27 money. It could be 2-3 month delay. And I think a lot of the citizens around the state need to get their fuel ordered and a few things early. So it's kind of a timing issue. And maybe, Mr. Chairman, you could touch on that. I think that was one of the major concerns to actually overrode the normal process of taking the surplus in 26 and rolling it into the SBR, the statutory budget reserve, which takes a simple majority, or the CBR, the Constitutional Budget Reserve, which takes a supermajority at 3/4. So maybe you can highlight
that. Yes, I could. I'll bring back my staff, Mr. Eklund, to explain the dilemma we're facing, particularly this year, in trying to get the funds to the people that are experiencing high costs.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Pete Eklund again, staff, Senator Hoffman, and the committee. The way the language was written, Mr. Chairman, was to make the determination of the available funds in August or prior to August. So particularly for the energy relief portion of the PFD of $150, to make sure that that revenue is available. So OMB and the executive branch can execute that appropriation, Mr. Chairman.
With that, I will maintain my objection. Do you have any closing comments, Senator Kaufman?
No, again, just to reiterate, I think it's good to keep the buckets of money from year to year clean, and I'm not fully informed on these operational issues, if it really is a constraint, but I think it's good to have the discussion, and that's the spirit in which I offer this amendment. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Kaufman. I will maintain my objection. Roll call, please.
Senator Merrick.
No.
Senator Cronk.
Yes.
Senator Kaufman.
Yes.
Senator Keel.
No. No.
Senator Hoffman.
No.
Senator Olson.
No.
Senator Stedman.
No.
2 yeas, 5 nays.
That motion fails. Senator Kaufman, do you have another?
No, I just thank the committee for hearing these amendments, and I hope some of these ideas can be incorporated into some budget somewhere in the not too far future.
Thank you, Senator Kaufman. Senator Cronk, do you have amendments?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I move amendment number 4.
You move amendment number 4?
Correct.
I'll object. Can you explain what you're trying to do with your amendment, Senator Kaufman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This amendment would direct $1 million to the Department of Administration to complete the Alaska Geographic Pay Differential Study. AS 3927030 requires that the Department of Administration Division of Personnel complete this study every 5 years, but the last comprehensive study was actually done in 2008. We're almost 20 years overdue for an updated geographic differential study. We as a state cannot expect to remain competitive in a job market when private opportunities pop up, especially in rural areas where the cost of goods and services are often higher than most rural areas. And I can specifically talk about the Tokyo area. We had a mine open up, and you know, obviously when those wages in that mine are there, those people working in DOT are going to jump ship and go over there because we're not even close to being competitive. So this study would help the state remain competitive as an employer, and I ask for your support in this amendment. And I just want to say in the 2008 study, it was a very flawed study because in one of my many areas that I represent, they actually said it's much cheaper to live out there than it is in urban Alaska. And so there's a zero geo-difference pay for many of my rural areas, and that's simply not fair. So what this money would do is give a good new study and hopefully would update that for those people that are employed out there.
I guess my main objection is money is tight. Even if we had millions and millions more, we had the GeoDiff study, we don't necessarily have the dollars to do it. We had a salary study that still hasn't been implemented, and I think the legislature, both House and Senate, and the administration needs to concentrate on how we are going to go forward with additional revenues to meet the demands of our students, our public safety, our public health. That, I think, is where the work should be spent by the legislature and this administration in the foreseeable future until we can pay for the services that the people of Alaska expect government should provide. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A little bit torn on this one. I think Senator Cronk is correct that our geographic differentials right now don't adequately reflect the cost of paying people what it takes to hire and hire them where they live. My understanding is that there's a version of this in the other body's budget, and so I'd like the opportunity to work with the members as we move into the conference process. I'm not going to support this amendment at this time, but I think it's really worth working on as we move forward. So I'm gonna oppose this for inclusion in our budget now, but I'd like to have further conversations.
Thank you, Senator Keel. Closing comments, Senator Cronk. Seeing none, I maintain my objection. Roll call, please.
Senator Cronk.
Yes.
Senator Kaufman.
Yes.
Senator Keel.
No.
Senator Merrick.
No.
Senator Hoffman.
No.
Senator Olson.
No. No.
Senator Stedman.
No.
2 yeas, 5 nays.
Thank you. That motion fails as well. Are there any other amendments to come before the committee at this time? Now I'll set this bill aside for consideration for the Finance Committee tomorrow. That brings us to the item on our agenda, which is HB 265, the Mental Health Budget. Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that the Finance Committee adopt the Senate Committee Substitute for Committee Substitute for House Bill 265, Finance 34-GH2502-W before the committee as our working document.
And I will object to go over the details by my staff, Pete Eklund. Mr. Eklund, you have the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, for the record, Pete Eklund's staff to Senator Hoffman in the Senate Finance Committee. And Mr. Chairman, I just want to correct a detail that on my last response about when the revenue would have to be determined. It's August 31st by the Commissioner of Revenue to help to ensure there's enough adequate funds so the executive branch could execute the $150 PFD energy relief payment. So I just wanted to correct that, Mr. Chairman. So the changes from CS1 of HB 265 version O, that's the version of the mental health bill we adopted last week, and the new CS version W in front of you, it's just a minor change, Mr. Chairman. The only changes from CS1 to CS2 is the approval of the PSEA, or the Public Safety Employees Association contracts, and they can be found on page 16, section 9 of the bill, the salary and benefits adjustments section in subsections 11 and 12. Those are the changes, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. With that, I'll remove my objection. This will be, are there further objection to adopting this CS as a working document? Seeing none, this CS has been adopted. Do any members have amendments for this bill? Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move amendment number one.
And I'll object for explanation.
Mr. Chairman, amendment number one adds $5,150,000 to the homeless assistance program. We've got a homeless problem, particularly in the Anchorage area, and there was a submission from Alaska Mental Health that would have included these funds, but it was not supported by the administration, submitted at a lower number to the committee, which we adopted in the version of the bill. So this amendment, Mr. Chairman, would bring the funding back up to what the Alaska Mental Health Trust asked for initially for the homeless assistance program.
And I will remove my objection to that amendment. Is there further objection to the adoption of amendment number one, Senator?
Only for comment, Keel. Mr. Chairman.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think this is important. I had my areas where I'm a little bit critical of the current administration, but I want to flag that the Alaska Department of Law and the municipality of Anchorage have been have partnered up on some of the what they on the crimes that. How would you phrase it, that affect people's quality of life tend to be more minor crimes on the severity ladder, but they matter. And really that's geared toward some of the areas with the biggest homelessness problem in Anchorage. Partnerships are good, and I think this is a model that is starting to bear some fruit in Anchorage. You cannot address a homelessness problem on a law enforcement response alone. In the end, you'll just compound it. So this I see is really complementary. This I see is really helping that portion of it that goes to that area. Getting some of those services, getting some of those folks housed, along with a more serious influence or focus on enforcing the law, together can make a huge difference in our largest city. So I just want to applaud the current effort and highlight that this amendment really will make it much more effective, and so it's a great way to go.
Thank you, Senator Keel. Further comments by members of the Senate Finance Committee on amendment number one? Is there additional objection to amendment number one? Seeing no objection, amendment number one will be incorporated into the CS. We will set this bill aside for consideration on tomorrow's calendar. Now we go to the next item before the Finance Committee, that being Senate Bill 217, Employer Contributions. This is the first hearing on this bill. I invite to the table to introduce Senate Bill 217, Robert Doyle, Policy Advisor to the Office of Governor. Please come forward with anyone that you would like to assist you in presenting to the Finance Committee what you are trying to accomplish here today.
Robert Boyle, Policy Advisor and Consultant to the Office of the Governor and to the Chair, to members of the Committee. Delighted that you're here. And Senate Bill 217, Committee Substitute. The Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund has experienced strong and sustained growth over the last several years, and it's become overcapitalized. Currently, there's no effective measure to balance out that fund and to keep it the way it should balance out. There's three contributing factors to that: taxes, benefits that are paid out, and training programs that are supported through the trust fund. Senate Bill 217, Committee Substitute, addresses all three, and it provides balancing mechanisms for future stable growth. I could go on about how important this bill can be to our training programs and to the benefit of our citizens through unemployment benefits when needed, but you're probably going to want a lot more detail than I can provide for you. So here to assist me is Director of Employment and Training for Department of Labor, Paloma Harbor, and the Unemployment Trust Fund Actuarial Economist, Lennon Welker.
We call the Senate Finance Committee meeting back to order. Looks like it was worth the wait. We're going to have a whale of a presentation here. So, Palm Harbor, please give us your presentation.
Thank you. For the record, Paloma Harbor. I'm the director for the Division of Employment and Training Services within the Department of Labor and Workforce Development. And thank you for this opportunity to present to you on Senate Bill 217, the Employer Contributions Bill, Committee Substitute, Labor and Commerce Committee Substitute, Version G. I do have with me Lennon Weller. I'll let him introduce himself real quick.
Good afternoon, Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Lennon Weller. I'm an economist with the Department of Labor's Research and Analysis Section, and I function as the actuary for the unemployment insurance system.
Okay. Oh. I need to figure out how to. Okay. So this first slide for the committee is to show the picture of where we are currently, or where the unemployment and trust fund balance has been since January 2006 through December 2025. The black line is the trust fund balance, and the two gray lines are what the statutory solvency target range is, which is 3 to 3.3% of taxable wages or wages in the state. And then how that balance compares to that target solvency range. As of December 2025, the balance of $833 million exceeded that target solvency by $250 million. As mentioned previously, this overcapitalization is primarily related to statutory minimum tax rates and a record low unemployment benefits payments. So this next slide shows for you the tax rates for all employer rate classes. A lot of times when we present on the unemployment trust or the unemployment insurance program, we present the average employer wage, which is rate classes 10 and 11. But there are 21 rate classes. The 21st rate class is the penalty rate class, and then rate classes 1 through 20, employers are supposed to be assigned to a rate class based on their actual experience. Because of the overcapitalization of the trust fund, all employers in non-penalty rate classes 1 through 20 have been paying the minimum tax of 1%. This slide is from our January trends issue, the Alaska Economic Trends publication that the Research and Analysis section sends out monthly, which was a jobs outlook for 2026. And it is just so that I can speak to the fact that we're experiencing record employment in the state as far as demand for workers. At the same time, you know, we have a lower working age population, and so there's more demand than we can meet with current supply, at least as far as the skills and training that our citizens have to meet those job demands. So this is further reflected in the following slide, which comes from the February Trends publication, which highlighted non-residents working in Alaska. Actually, this is probably from the non-residents working in Alaska report. And they show that we have a higher reliance on non-residents trying to meet that employer demand for a skilled workforce. We have, through this bill, a proposed solution to this problem, which is the State Training and Employment Program. This is a program that the department already administers. It is meant to enhance the quality of in-state training and employment assistance to build up an Alaskan workforce to meet Alaska's employers' needs. But the current demand for this funding is far exceeding our available revenue. In fiscal year 2026, the Alaska Workforce Investment Board received a total of $11.2 million in applications, but they only had $7 million in funding available to grant out. And the Alaska Job Center Network, which provides grants to individuals, is running out through its funding before the end of the fiscal year. This legislation, Senate Bill 217, makes a number of changes that will help increase available training funding and reduce the employer UI taxes to bring that trust fund balance more in alignment with where it should be according to the statutory target solvency, and help us meet, at least in the short term, the increased employer demand that we are experiencing, not for just basic occupations forecast, but also the upcoming pipeline and major projects out there that are on the horizon. So the first change is to employee taxes. This bill, currently in current statute, employees contribute a tax of 0.25% of wages to the technical and vocational education program, a 0.1% tax to the state training and employment program, and then the remaining tax goes to the unemployment insurance trust fund of 0.15%. Under the current version of Senate Bill 217, we are doubling the employee contribution to the state training and employment program, and this would be in perpetuity. So moving forward, revenue to STEP would be doubling into the foreseeable future. Okay. The other change for the state training and employment program is that as employer contributions for UI remain low or at zero or less than 0.4%, employers are able to contribute to the state training and employment program a brand new tax of 0.4%. So it's an overall tax savings to employers of 0.6%, and until UI contributions are needed, it's a bump up in our available training funding so we can meet emergent demands now. And then, as I mentioned, an ongoing doubling of the funding into the future. So this slide is showing you those training program revenue projections over time through 2040. As I mentioned briefly, average employer taxes, currently all employers are paying the statutory minimum tax of 1%. So shown on this slide is baseline, no change, from 2027 to 2040. And then the proposed change in Senate Bill 217 of a step tax of 0.4% or a new minimum tax of 0.4%, whether that's going to STEP or unemployment insurance, and then an increase as the unemployment insurance program needs further contributions. And again, this is the average tax rate, so I did provide one more slide to just show you all the different rate classes and the fact that, yes, at some point, the highest rate classes do go back up to 1%, but they never very significantly exceed that 1% that they're currently paying. So that actually concludes my presentation. But what I forgot to mention, the other part of this legislation, and I should have mentioned it, is the benefits side. So this legislation does increase the unemployment insurance benefit from its current level of $370 per week to $470 per week. That benefit has not been increased since 2009. And the $470 figure equates to an equivalent of the wage change since that time. And so that's how the 470 figure was determined. Any questions?
Questions? Senator Kaufman.
Thank you. Just curious, could we go back to slide 5? I'd just like to chat about something there. And it's just interesting that division of where non-residents worked in the different sectors is an interesting spread. It's not there's a lot of narratives around that one industry or another is the big user of non-state employees, but it's broadly distributed, and some of the industries that are often pointed at are not actually the largest slices of pie there. And I just thought that was, it's just a presentation that's just worth considering. Sometimes the things that you hear people talking about are not always reflected when you see the data. And just thank you for that.
Further questions by the Senate Finance Committee?
Thank you, Mr. And I'm actually on page 5, so I'm looking at that. I'm a little surprised. Where does Comm Fish Workers fall in here as non-residents? Is it all other?
Through the chair, Senator Kronk, they are not. Will, so this is covered employment, I believe. So this would be individuals that are contributing to unemployment insurance, self-employment, and commercial fishing is generally not included.
Thank you.
Senator Kelly, then okay. Senator Kaufman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Weller, do you have the same slide but in dollars versus percentages, or Ms. Harbor?
Through the chair, Senator Merrick, there's a whole publication. I did print a copy, the non-resident worker report, and there's so many different charts and ways to slice and dice this information.
Senator Kelly.
Thank you. Just following up with what Ms. Senator Kaufman said, oil, mining and oil are obviously ones that we hear about the non-resident workforce making a lot of money. So it'd be interesting to see the dollar difference versus the percentage difference. I think it would be significantly higher than, say, leisure and hospitality.
Can you have that disseminated to the members of the Finance Committee at a future date?
Absolutely.
Yes.
Senator Kaufman.
Thank you. The programs that the money's going to, do we have any statistics on how effective they are? What's the ratios or percentage of folks that get out of the program and then are quickly employed, or yep. Is there a high efficiency there?
Through the chair, Senator Kaufman, yes, there's an annual program performance report specifically for the state training and employment program that shows. So we do a training program performance report for all of the training programs we administer for the Department of Labor. I'm sorry, through the chair, did I say through the chair? Senator Kaufman. And it shows percentage employed 2 quarters after and 4 quarters after. It also shows the increase in wages and various statistics that are actually outlined in statute. And so we can provide a copy of that. I would say that the state training and employment program is one of the highest performing programs in that report. So that's worth highlighting.
Yeah. Follow up.
Senator Kaufman.
Thank you. So is there a performance threshold that meet this or else you lose funding? Do we have where there's carrots thrown around or any sticks?
Through the chair, Senator Kaufman. The Alaska Workforce Investment Board reviews the competitive grant applications each year, and performance is definitely one of the factors they look at in making those awards. But I can't speak to that in depth because I'm not over that process, but we could get more information for you.
That'd be great. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Senator Kaufman. Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd just like to follow up on Senator Kronk's question. I think he asked about the fishing industry, mm-hmm. but how about the processing?
Yep.
That's a little different than the fishermen themselves.
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, seafood processing shows up in manufacturing.
Senator Stedman.
Okay, and then is there a further breakdown for that? So where does the oil service workers, where do they fit in? Are they in the manufacturing? Because that was part of the earlier question, I think. And those are the two big groups that we normally talk about.
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, I don't know exactly how low the data goes. Research and analysis could speak to that further. Oil is in the mining and oil category, but I know that there are some occupations that might fall. I don't want to speak over information that I'm not 100% familiar with. I think our research and analysis section could get you a better answer.
Senator Stedman.
Yeah, if they could get back to us, Mr. Chairman, on the oil basin as a whole. I know they might have different roles up there than the fishing industry.
Sure.
That would be helpful for other meetings and just
thank
good
you,
data.
Senator Stedman. Further questions of the Finance Committee, Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Start with just a super basic question. The employer contributions by class. Can you just, for the public listening, can you orient us to what puts an employer in class 1 versus class 8 versus 19?
Absolutely, through the chair, Senator Keel. I'll let our actuarial economist speak to that.
Again, for the record, Lennon Weller. Through the chair, Senator Keel. So we have what's referred to as an indirect experience rating system. It's referred to as a payroll decline system. And so essentially what we do is we look at employers with history of employment in the state, a minimum of 6 quarters, and calculate an average decline in their payroll quarter to quarter. And those who have a higher average decline in their payroll find themselves in a higher tax class, where those with a lower relative payroll decline quarter to quarter find themselves in a lower rate class 1, for example. And there's what we assign them based on an experience factor, 0.4 being the lowest experience factor relative to the average rate class. Again, that's the 10 and 11 rate classes, and I believe it's 1.6 is the highest experience factor for rate class 20. And the department attempts to put roughly 5% of wages in each one of those specific tax classes.
So it sounds like the general goal is if you seem to be laying people off a lot, you're going to pay a little more to the unemployment insurance?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, that's exactly right.
Yeah, follow up then, if I may.
Keel.
Where does a brand new business start?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, so we have a new classification. It's an industry rate class, and that's for those who don't have any experience, obviously, new employers in the state, and they're assigned a rate based on the average of the rates applied to all employers of that same industry that do have experience with the system.
Senator Keel.
On a slightly different topic, if I may, Mr. Chairman, on the weekly benefit increase, if I'm reading the bill right, and correct me where I've got it wrong, it does not seem to apply at the lowest, an increase at the lowest quarterly earnings. Am I understanding that right? And if so, what's the thinking?
Through the chair, Senator Keel. So the benefit schedule is arranged so that at different earnings during your base period, you're eligible for different wage replacement, basically. And for an unemployment program in general, the goal, I guess, at a federal level is to about 50% wage replacement. So our schedule, if you look at the $2,500 in earnings and you look at the benefit, the corresponding benefit, it is actually more than even 100% wage replacement if you look at it over 52 weeks. And then as you get closer to that 370 figure, you get closer to a 50% wage replacement. The schedule that you see in the bill has actually changed. It used to be a strict $2 increment for each $250 in earnings. The current schedule now will increase by $2 or $3 to try and hit that target of 50% wage replacement, depending on where you earn. So that's kind of how the schedule is built out.
Thank you, Senator Keel.
Okay. I'll think on that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We will open the public hearing at this time. We have several people across the state of Alaska that would like to testify on this particular piece of legislation. We will start in Anchorage and go to Shirley McCaw, who's the program manager for mining and petroleum training services for the University of Alaska in Fairbanks. Shirley, please identify yourself and proceed with your 2 minutes of testimony.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Shirley McKay. I'm in Anchorage, and I'm the program manager for Mining and Petroleum Training Service. We're also known as MAPS. MAPS is a workforce training provider and partner to the Department of Labor by sharing common mission of training and retaining Alaskans to fill Alaska jobs. MAPS provides entry-level training for high-demand industries, such as heavy equipment operation, surface and underground mining, as well as oil and gas. We train all Alaskans, but with a broad reach being the underserved and remote communities who have no other path to skilled, well-paid work. This expansion of the STEP funding will significantly increase this opportunity to individuals with more participants trained and more communities served. A remote, immersive, two-week camp gives participants a focused, distraction-free environment to develop industry-ready skills. This Bill Rule 217 would strengthen STEP's long-term stability and allow us to train more Alaskans to fill the state's growing demand of the skilled workforce. We strongly urge you for your support, and I really thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. McKay. We'll go to Palmer, where we'll hear from Charity Osborne, who is the manager of Alaska Operating Engineers, Employers, and Training Trust. Please identify yourself and proceed with your 2 minutes of testimony.
Yes, good afternoon. My name is Charity Osborne, and I'm from the Alaska Operating Engineers Employers Training Trust. We train Alaskans for high-demand careers in construction, heavy equipment operations, and resource development, serving about 350 participants annually across roughly 1,700 training spots statewide. STEP funding has been essential in removing barriers like travel, lodging, and meals, especially for participants from rural and off-road communities. Without it, many Alaskans would not be able to access training or these career opportunities. And our programs lead directly to employment with contractors across Alaska, helping to fill critical workforce needs and reduce reliance on non-resident workers. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Charity. We'll go to Kenai, Chris Rayton, Executive Director for the Southeast Regional Resource Center.
Yes, for the record, this is Chris Raton. I'm the Executive Director of Southeast Regional Resource Center, CERC, and CERC strongly supports Senate Bill 217. This legislation represents a practical and timely investment in Alaska's workforce training system. As a workforce training provider, CERC has relied on STEP grant funding to support Southeast Alaskans by removing prohibitive financial barriers to high-cost technical certifications. This ensures that high-wage roles in maritime, welding, and transportation sectors are filled by skilled local residents rather than out-of-state workers. Additionally, STEP funding provides direct pathways to careers in the trades by financing essential credentials, including Class A and B CDLs, occupational endorsement certificates in welding, diesel mechanics, and construction, and United States Coast Guard approved marine endorsements. This investment is critical to rapidly upskilling local residents for high-wage, in-demand employment as commercial drivers, heavy-duty mechanics, certified fabricators, and maritime vessel operators. While Juneau serves as the primary training hub for CERC, the unique geography of Southeast Alaska often prevents rural residents from accessing these training opportunities. Increased funding would help to decentralize financial support beyond Juneau to outlying communities, effectively broadening the local talent pool and ensuring regional employers have access to a qualified resident workforce. This legislation is a high return investment in Alaska's workforce economy, and we respectfully urge your support. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Chris. We'll go to Anchorage.
Mr. Chairman, I got a question.
Mr. Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've got a question for Mr. Wright, and I was just wondering if you reside in Kenai or Juneau or because your identifier here on the iPad says you're out of Kenai, yet you're talking about Southeast.
Chris, are you still there? He's gone off the bar, so you can check up on that issue later, Senator Stedman. We'll go to Lynn Zender from Anchorage. Please identify yourself and proceed with your 2 minutes of testimony.
Hello. Thank you for the opportunity to speak. Can you hear me? Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay, great. Good afternoon. I'm heavily in support of SB217. We train about 20 students each year who are residents of the smaller communities outlying our rural hubs. And we recruit only those seeking work in their community or region if need be. On Friday night, we're graduating students from Mangoon, Togiak, Stony River, Atlantic, Manicotes, Newtok, Holy Cross, Togiak, Tuakla, Tunis, Chibornik, Quebec, and Stubbins. And 201, they are prospective local hire workers requiring the skills we teach them in order to replace the non-residents being hired instead and flown out at great cost to companies in the state. We focus on worker safety, transportation, movement of goods in and hazardous waste out, and sanitation. We're unique in that every class and certification are all specific to the unique rural Alaska conditions, which the members of this committee are aware, and which requires extreme worker competence and problem solving. We teach 260 hours of intensive certificates with about 15 recognized certifications. And we're extremely successful. We've got a job placement rate of 91%, retention of 84%. We've placed workers in 84 different communities. We've taught 190 graduates. But it's very expensive. We receive what are diminishing and uncertain U.S. EPA monies for about half our costs. We leverage in-kind instruction and supplies with over 10 different governmental, nonprofit, and for-profit entities each year, including the U.S. Coast Guard, the State Spill Response Program, UAF, and Total Reclaim. But because we're essentially teaching trades and hands-on work, nearly all of our teaching is done by flying students into Anchorage for 28 days and lodging them and feeding them. STEP is absolutely instrumental to our continued success in placing rural residents with critical jobs and careers that change lives. We know they change lives because we follow up with our graduates for a year and they tell us a trained and competent rural workforce is a wellness backbone of their families, communities, and the industries investing in them. Thank you.
Thank you, Lynn. We'll go to the far northwest, to Nome, Alaska. Pamela Cushman, please identify yourself. Proceed with your 2 minutes of testimony. Pamela, are you online? Are you in muted status?
Thank you. I was muted. Good afternoon, Chairman and Committee. My name is Pamela Cushman. I am the Workforce Development Director for Kowarik in Nome, Alaska. I am calling in support of this bill, especially because I'm a new applicant for this bill. Kowarik has multiple training programs that start with youth and then go into adulthood. And we have a couple major projects. I'm sure you guys are all aware. We have the Nome Port Project, Graphite One. We have Norton Sound Housing Construction and also IHS Housing Projects that are coming to Teller, Alaska. All of these positions require skilled persons, and our goal is to train our local residents. Funding dollars are short these days, and we are using rated funding to get as many trainees, as many regional people as we can trained to take these positions, so that they do not hire from outside our region. And that is why I'm in support of this STEP program.
Thank you for that testimony. Is there anyone else online that would like to testify? Is there anyone in the audience that would like to testify on Senate Bill 217? Seeing no other individuals to testify, Robert Boyle, do you have any closing comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. We've been looking at various ways to strengthen our STEP programs. You can see that they're well recognized across the state and been very well used. We encourage support.
Thank you. We will close the public hearing and go to Senator Keel to review the fiscal notes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There's a stack of fiscal notes for Senate Bill 217. First one I'll go to is the easiest one from Department of Labor and Workforce Development, Alaska Vocational Technical Center, AVTEC. They have a zero fiscal note because the instructors must pay the fees for the new background checks, although they will need to do regulations to require that. The next fiscal note on my list is from the Department of Labor and Workforce Development Unemployment Insurance. That shows that in addition to the $96,000 in the governor's request, the bill would require an additional $482,000 in FY27. That would step up a little to $532.7 in FY28 and then settle out at $515.5 going forward. The fund source identified for that is the STEP fund, all of which is DGF in each year. It identifies a substantial change in revenues, all in STEP funds as well. No increase in STEP revenues in FY27. However, the increase starts in 28 at $37,844.4, and then that begins to drop in the next year, $35,868.9, and then further declines into the out years at coming down to $15,893.1 in FY2032. Let's see. The next fiscal note I have is also from the Department of Labor and Workforce Development, and they all are. Workforce Investment Board fiscal note shows operating costs in the governor's FY27 budget, $18,955.7. Included in the governor's FY27 request is $7,589.3, but the bill would lead to an additional FY27 amount of $18,955.7. Those come together an increase in FY28 to $39,437.4. That number then drops gradually until FY2032 at $24,181.5. The fund source for that is, again, all STEP funds, DGF. This fiscal note also identifies, one additional full-time position in FY27 and then two in FY28 and going forward. Last fiscal note on this bill, Mr. Chairman, Department of Labor and Workforce Development, Workforce Services and Employment and Training Services. The Workforce Services fiscal note shows that the governor's request for 27 already has $2,465.3. The bill would add $4,688.9. Those would roll together an increase in FY28 to $9,764.2. That number dropping gradually and then a little more speedily to an FY2032 number of $5,950.2. The fund source for all of those is the STEP fund, which, of course, is designated general fund.
Thank you, Senator Keel. With that, we will set this bill aside for the committee's further deliberations. Brings us to the last item on today's calendar, Senate Bill 251, Repeal Workers' Comp Appeals Commission. This is the first hearing on this bill. I invite Senator Wilikowski and his staff, David Densmore, to the table to tell us what he's trying to do to us.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, Bill Wilikowski, State Senator, representing East Anchorage, and I'm here with David Densmore in my office. This is a little bit of an unusual bill in that I'm not coming to you asking for money. I'm not coming to you to grow government. I'm coming to you asking to do just the opposite. I'm coming to you asking to save money, asking you to help us, the state, prevent a tax increase on the business community. and helping us to shrink government. This is a bill that's been around for many years. It's passed both bodies over the time. It will repeal the Workers' Compensation Appeals Commission and return those cases back to the Superior Court, the court that handled these cases for decades. It will save at least $518,300. The Workers' Compensation Appeals Commission, when it first started out, had 42 cases and issued 22 decisions. In 2023, they issued 3 decisions. And we'll have a chart here that shows the steady long-term decline of cases. The caseload just isn't there. And what's happening is the Alaska Workers' Compensation Program has a growing budget deficit. This bill will reduce that deficit. That the Alaska Workers' Safety and Compensation Program is intended to be funded by taxes on workers' compensation insurance premiums, but those taxes are no longer sufficient to fund the program. And so the State General Fund is now bridging that gap. This will help close that gap, which will prevent further general fund expenditures and prevent, quite frankly, a future tax increase, which is very likely on the business community to pay for future increases. The Superior Court is very well equipped to handle these cases. They've done them for decades, and we think this is a reasonable measure to help save the state a little bit of money. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Do members of the Finance Committee have questions of the sponsor of this particular piece of legislation? We do have in the room the director of the Workman's Compensation, Charles Collins, as well for questions, if members would have them at this point or at a later time during the meeting. We do not have any invited testimony. However, we have two individuals that would like to testify on this particular piece of legislation. Both are from Anchorage. Dyer Ford, please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony. Are you on mute?
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Proceed.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Dave Ford. I'm a retired Alaska attorney with I practiced in the workers' compensation arena for about 25 years. Then I was a hearing officer for 3.5 years and chair of the appeals commission for 8 years. I'm now fully retired. I would like to address some aspects of the importance of the commission to the workers' compensation community that I think are important and would be lost if the Superior Court were to take over after the last, today's 26th, the last 21 years of the commission's activities. The most important consideration for the commission's decisions are that they have precedential value, unlike Superior Court decisions. That is, when the commission issues a decision, which is done by a panel of 3 people, the chair merely writes the decision, the panel makes the decision as to whether affirm, modify, remand, or somehow affect the board's decisions. The value of a precedential decision, meaning that it can stand as the law until revised or reversed by the Alaska Supreme Court, is that that decision provides guidance to all the parties, including the board, in going forward the future litigation. It provides a basis from which lawyers can evaluate a claim and advise their clients, whether it's an employee or an employer. It also advises the board on how it should look at decisions. The board has many hearing officers, and each hearing officer's decision applies only to the parties before it. The same with a Superior Court decision. It applies only to the parties to that appeal. Therefore, everybody has to evaluate in a field of uncertainty how their particular case might go before the board, depending on the hearing officer, or before the Superior Court, depending on the Superior Court judge. It's a, the lawyers and the board both are operating in a sea of some ambiguity, which makes it difficult, but at the same time, perhaps makes litigation more costly, because if you don't have a line, a bright line, you may roll the dice onto whether you should appeal a decision or not. An employer can look at this and say, well, there's two board decisions out here. They go different ways. I'm going to challenge this employee, this injured worker's claim, because I might just win. And that is not good for any of the parties to the workers' comp system. Also, the Superior Court has a very heavy workload, and while they are very diligent and they do an outstanding job, I'm sure, as they did prior to 2005, in hearing cases, their decisions have no precedential value, and it just adds another hefty workload to their already loaded calendars. There's another area that I wish to bring up, and that is people tend to forget that a significant number of injured workers represent themselves either before the board or before the commission or before both. And the commission clerk is in an outstanding position to help guide these injured workers and sometimes new attorneys through the process of an appeal, which, as any attorney can tell you, can be an arduous undertaking. The clerk is familiar with the appellate rules and with the kind of presentation is needed in an appeal. So the judges, the Superior Court judges' clerks simply don't have that kind of expertise, number one, as to the appellate rules, and number two, the time to give a pro se appellant the kind of attention that they might need and seek. The Supreme Court has mandated that pro se parties must be given directions as to correcting deficiencies in their pleadings. And, you know, I am concerned that a Superior Court clerk, although they try their best, may not be able and have the sufficient background to provide the same kind of help to the unrepresented litigant that the commission clerk has at her disposal. These are just a couple of points I would like you to consider in considering this particular bill, which has been tried many times before and has not yet succeeded.
Thank you, Ms. Ford, for your...
I'm available to take any questions.
Seeing no questions, we'll continue on with public hearing. The public hearing testimony, stay in Anchorage, Martha Tansk with the law firm of Paddock and Budzinski. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your 2 minutes of testimony.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, and through the chair, senators. My name is Martha Tansk. I'm an Anchorage attorney, and the majority of my practice is in workers' compensation defense. The issue of the Appeals Commission is certainly a challenging one for everyone involved. I myself have been on the recipient end of some precedent-changing decisions from the Commission, and I'm under no illusion that it's a perfect system. I don't believe there is such thing as a perfect system. That said, I do oppose Senate Bill 251 to abolish the Commission. As you are all by now well aware, there are a few major concerns that Ms. Ford articulated with repealing the Commission and returning the first layer of appeals back to the Superior Court. In particular, there are three that I think are really important: subject matter complexity, lack of Superior Court resources, and failure to meet the intention of the Alaska Workers' Compensation Act. Superior Court judges, as Ms. Ford discussed, are generalists, but as far as I'm aware, very few of the current Superior Court judges, perhaps two, have a background in workers' compensation. Workers' compensation is an extremely nuanced area and a relatively complex one. The statutes have been modified extensively by board case law and by appeals commission law. For appeals from the board level, it's really important to have individuals who are familiar with the Alaska Workers' Compensation Act adjudicating the appeal. That familiarity ultimately reduces the likelihood of an appeal to the Supreme Court, increases judicial efficiency, and increases the likelihood of a consistent body of law. without that precedential value of the commission, there's little incentive to accept the ruling of the superior court. It becomes more like a speed bump. Having subject matter expertise also matters for predictability. There's no indication the superior court would be correct more often than the commission. And if the commission's precedential, it helps keep the cases from arising on appeal to start with because all of the parties are clearer on the rules, and that reduces the workload all around. And that allows for cost efficiencies in the workers' compensation litigation system altogether that would not exist without the commission. The second issue is the lack of resources at the Superior Court. The legislature has previously heard testimony that the court would do its best to accommodate the increase in caseload, but they're stretched thin. And that's even more so now than in 2017 or 2020 or 2024 when the issue is previously explored. As you all are no doubt aware, there are often lengthy delays in hearings and trials. And that kind of delay is simply not beneficial for injured workers who are seeking relief, nor is it beneficial for the employers and the insurers who are seeking resolution of their cases or resolution of a single issue. Not only will it take an extended amount of time to be heard on argument, but it's my understanding that the Supreme Court has 6 months to render a decision, whereas the Appeals Commission only has 30 days.
Ms. Tance, can you provide us
to have a hearing within 6 months?
Ms. Tance, can you provide us with a summary of your testimony? You're over your 2 minutes.
Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anyone else online that would like to testify at this time? Is there anyone in the room that would like to testify? We do have Nancy Mead available for committee questions if any finance members have additional questions. We'll bring back Senator Wilkowski for closing comments before we hear for fiscal notes and set this bill aside. Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Bill Wilkowski representing East Anchorage. We do have a presentation that's in your packets you can look at. I will address some of the comments that were made. Number one, on the issue of pro se litigants, the Superior Court deals with thousands of pro se litigants, probably more, many more pro se litigants than they have cases represented by attorneys. So I don't think that's an issue at all. Number two, I would note that when the Superior Court handled these appeals years ago, 25% of the decisions were appealed to the Supreme Court. Since 2011, 54% of the commission decisions have been appealed. In terms of the workload, there, I would note the court system has issued a zero fiscal note for this for probably the fifth or sixth year in a row, and that's because in 2020, the Workers' Compensation Appeals Commission issued three decisions. Five decisions were appealed to the Supreme Court, 50% of the cases. In 2022, they issued five decisions. 2023, they issued five decisions. 2024, they issued four decisions. In 2025, they issued three decisions, 100% of which in 2025 were appealed to the Supreme Court. And so commission is uniquely situated to issue decisions, they're having an extraordinary number that are issued to the Supreme, that are going to the Supreme Court. So it's actually not saving time, it's actually costing the courts time. And on the issue of the experience, these are not particularly complex cases, Mr. Chairman. These are workers' compensation cases. I used to be a workers' compensation hearing officer. It can't be that hard if I was able to do it. I would note that there are very complex cases out there like property cases, uniform commercial code cases, probate cases, China cases. The Superior Court handled extremely complex cases. These are no more complicated. They require no more specialized knowledge. This is simply a way to save $500,000 per year, to save a tax going on the business community, to save a little money from the general fund, to shrink government a little bit. These are the kind of things we need to do to get our budget situation under control. And I would appreciate the committee's support. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Wilkowski. Senator Keel.
Fiscal notes, Mr. Chairman?
Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There are two fiscal notes for Senate Bill 251. Fiscal note number one is from the judicial branch of government and the trial courts. As the sponsor noted, they assign a zero fiscal note. Second fiscal note is from the Department of Labor and Workforce Development and the Workers' Compensation Appeals Commission allocation. They show that the, FY 27 decrease in spending would be $259,500, $259,500, which is made up of $246,500 in DGF and $13,000 in UGF. In FY28, the savings or the decrease in spend rises, so it would show a decrease of $518.3, of which $25.3 is UGF. The remaining $493 is DGF. It would also show a reduction of two permanent full-time positions. The agency does note that they would need to change some regulations.
Questions on the fiscal notes? Senator Keel, you have a question on your fiscal notes.
I just want to make sure, am I understanding correctly, $500,000 and two positions for five cases a year?
That's correct. Roughly $100,000 per case.
Thank you, Senator Keel, for pointing that out. With that, we'll set this bill aside for further consideration at a later date by the Senate Finance Committee. That concludes this afternoon's meeting. Our next meeting is scheduled for tomorrow morning at 9 a.m., where we will continue discussions on HB 263, the operating budget, and HB 265, the mental health budget, along with HB 39, education for the deaf and hard of hearing, HB 48, civil legal services fund, and Senate Bill 206, suicide prevention policies, firearm storage. Anything else to come before the committee at this time? Seeing none, we are adjourned till tomorrow morning.